I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An alternately defiant and downcast Saddam Hussein appeared in a Baghdad courtroom today to answer to preliminary charges of war crimes and genocide. After arriving in handcuffs, Hussein insisted he was still the president of Iraq, that the court proceedings were theater, and that the real criminal was George Bush. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Time magazine correspondent Vivian Walt. Vivian, I understand you were watching the hearings on television with Iraqis?
I was. I was in a restaurant in Baghdad, and the place, as you can imagine, just stopped. People were just completely astonished. In fact, nobody said a word for about 5 minutes. They just left their tables, left the food on the tables, and just crowded around one tiny television set in the corner of the restaurant. Well, it was after things were over that the debate really started flying hot and fast.
Was anyone angry seeing him in the docket? Did he have supporters in the crowd you saw?
Oh, he certainly did. In the restaurant I was at, a few people stood up and shouted, Saddam is not a criminal, he's not guilty, he should not be in this courtroom, the whole thing is a sham. And I have to say, I was somewhat taken aback by how candid they were in public. But there is still a very strong strain of support for him in this country. We see it manifested in the violence, of course, every day. But beyond the violence, there are a lot of people who I would think daily regard him with some great nostalgia.
The BBC is reporting that Hussein appeared disoriented in the hearing. He kept asking, what's going on? Your take on that?
It was a little confusing at first because there was no audio. It took a while for the military to actually clear the sound being broadcast. All you saw was the pictures at first. I had heard that before from the head of the special tribunal who I saw a couple of nights ago, and he had described Saddam's current state of mind as being somewhat confused about things. It's not entirely clear how much news Saddam gets to watch or listen to these days or read, and it is possible this whole process, which is very confusing to many Iraqis, is also somewhat confusing to Saddam himself. And there he is in the dock, completely powerless, not even defended by a defense counsel today.
He was asked to sign the list of preliminary charges against him without a lawyer present. He refused to do that. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it was a fairly crafty move. It meant that he simply wouldn't recognize the legitimacy of the court. It was also a signal to a lot of the Arab countries in this region who likewise do not recognize the legitimacy of this court. So you can read actually quite a lot in that simple gesture. And Saddam was always kind of a master at gestures, if you remember.
Well, Vivian, finally, he had an open shirt, a jacket, a neatly trimmed graying beard. Tell us, how did Iraqis react to just seeing him, physically seeing him?
More than one person who said to me, he's just not the Saddam we know. He looks so strange to us, and we just don't believe that it's really him. And to see him really totally brought to such a point of isolation, I think was very disorienting to a lot of Iraqis.
Vivian, thank you.
Thank you.
Vivian Walt, correspondent for Time magazine and the Boston Globe, she spoke to us from Baghdad. Well, a study of the mental health of U.S. soldiers returning from Iraq is providing information that may improve treatment options in the military. 90% of the soldiers said they'd been shot at. 20% said they saved the life of another soldier or a civilian. Over half said they killed someone, and 80% said they saw a woman or child they could not help. Joining us on the line is Lieutenant Colonel Carl Castro, a co-principal investigator of the study, which was published today in the New England Journal of Medicine. Lieutenant Colonel Castro, one result that jumped out at us, one out of five soldiers had experienced hand-to-hand combat?
Well, you know, the way soldiers interpret that question, I think, is important. In interviews that we conducted with the soldiers who completed our survey, this hand-to-hand combat, they interpreted in a variety of ways. In some cases, there was sort of literally, you know, hand-to-hand, you know, point-blank range combat activities going on. And in other cases, when they would, say, search houses and have to detain Iraqis for, you know, potential interviews, et cetera. They consider that hand-to-hand combat as well.
Yeah. According to reports, the study shows that there's still a stigma on the part of soldiers about getting mental health help. What was your response to that?
Well, you're right. There is a stigma, both a cultural stigma and organizational barriers that exist that prevent soldiers from getting help. But we try to encourage soldiers to seek the care they need in order to maintain their readiness and their fitness to accomplish their mission. We recognize that mental health has an associated stigma, but we are working very hard developing policies and programs to attenuate or lessen that stigma.
I'm reading a list of what some of the soldiers surveyed said would happen if they asked for mental health help. I would be seen as weak. My unit's leadership would treat me differently. Members of my unit might have less confidence in me. It made us think of the soldier during the Iraq War who wanted to leave the force because he felt he was having a breakdown. He was dishonorably discharged. I don't expect you to comment on that case or others, but do you think that this survey will change the thinking towards soldiers who feel they're having mental breakdowns during war?
Well, one of the things that please keep in mind that the stigma questions that you read back to me is from the perception of the soldier.
Right.
It's what the soldier thinks other people will think about him or her. But when you ask soldiers, how would you think of somebody else? There really is almost no stigma. Soldiers report that they wouldn't think of less of someone else if they admitted that they had a mental health problem. So it's this type of stigma that we're trying to work to eliminate.
I guess I'm asking, will these findings not only help the soldiers who are seeking mental health, but perhaps the military in adjusting their attitude towards someone who's having mental issues on the battlefield?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The thing I think is we know that war and combat affects soldiers. We've known that from all of our other previous wars that we fought. We know that there's a cultural stigma towards mental health, both in the military and in the civilian population. What our study did was put numbers on what we thought we already knew. And that's important because now when we implement our changes to reduce these barriers and stigmas, we will actually have numbers in which to compare to see whether or not our programs are working.
Lieutenant Colonel Carl Castro, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Lieutenant Colonel Carl Castro of the Walter Reed Research Institute in Silver Spring, Maryland. This news note from Afghanistan. Despite earlier promises by President Hamid Karzai and American officials, elections scheduled for September in Afghanistan will be delayed because of infighting among government officials and political parties. President Karzai had said repeatedly that elections would go ahead in September, despite increased violence against election workers and the fear that warlords will intimidate voters. But according to a senior Afghan official, only 4 of the 20 political parties consulted by Afghanistan's election board want the vote to be held this fall. October is seen as the last chance to hold a vote this year. After that, snow closes parts of the remote Hindu Kush area until the spring of next year. Taking a single daily multivitamin has significantly slowed the progression of HIV/AIDS in pregnant women in Tanzania, according to Harvard University and Tanzanian doctors. And their study might lead researchers to look at more affordable alternatives to expensive antiretroviral medications to help fight HIV in developing nations. The study looked at more than 1,000 women over a period of 9 years. It found that women who took a simple multivitamin were 30% less likely to progress to the latest stage of HIV infection or to die during the study. Dr. Wafa El-Sadr is an HIV specialist at Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. She helps run treatment programs in Thailand and Africa. Dr. Sadr, you weren't involved in this particular study, but how important is this study for the population you work with?
I think the results of the study are very important and have important public health implications and important implications for people with HIV around the world. I think this intervention, the multivitamins, that the possibility of using a simple intervention like multivitamins, in addition to the other established ways of treating HIV disease, can have important implications in the lives of people with HIV around the world.
Well, do you worry, though, you said in addition, do you worry that multivitamins might become a replacement for the more expensive therapies?
I think it's important to keep in mind that the study, while very important, is not stating that that the multivitamins are the way to really manage HIV disease or is the only way to affect the progression of HIV disease in many of these settings. Even in the study itself, there was a significant proportion of the women who did progress to HIV or died, even in the group that received multivitamins. Therefore, I think and I'm sure that the authors would agree that this is an additional intervention that hopefully can have a substantial impact, and also that it is a simple intervention for populations that do not have access to other known interventions for management of HIV disease.
We understand that the other thing that the multivitamin does, in addition to seeming to slow the progression of HIV/AIDS, is that it seems to reduce a lot of the symptoms, the oral sores, the fatigue.
Actually, the biggest effect of the multivitamins that was seen in the study was primarily on infections in the mucosa or the surface membranes in patients with HIV. The study did show that there was a decrease in progression, but it appears that the most significant effect was actually on those kind of complications.
I'm wondering if it would have the same impact in the U.S. where people already take their multivitamins and get much of their vitamins from food. Is this because these populations don't have vitamins in their food or multivitamins normally?
It's unclear whether this is because the populations in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, are more likely to have deficiencies in vitamins, and therefore you're really giving them what they need, versus the populations here in the U.S., where in all likelihood most people do get everyday sufficient vitamins. In the United States, in the programs where I provide HIV care and treatment, we provide routinely multivitamins. In addition, in a program that we have established in several countries in sub-Saharan Africa and in Thailand, we also elected several years ago to provide multivitamins routinely to patients who are enrolled in that program. I think it's heartening to see the data which confirms this makes sense. It did make sense to us intuitively that a good proportion of the patients may have vitamin deficiencies, and that's the reason why we supplemented them with vitamins. But now I think it's nice to have the data to confirm an intuitive sense of the need for multivitamins.
Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, a professor of medicine at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, speaking on a new Harvard University study that shows a simple multivitamin slows the progression of HIV/AIDS in pregnant women in Tanzania. Just ahead, a new cafe opens in Amman, Jordan, where women are able to let their guard and their veils down. And later, the Polyphonic Spree singing on the Eternal Sunshine soundtrack about eternal sunshine. There's more coming up, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the most enduring images of life in parts of the Middle East is the veil that many women wear when they go out in public. For some, it's an imposition. For others, a badge of religious pride or a shield against unwanted advances from strange men. In all cases, home is where you take your veil off. But now a new cafe in Amman, Jordan, offers women another place where they can go out for a night and still let their guard and their veils down. Freelance reporter Kristen Gillespie visited the Sabaya Cafe.
Most shops open for business by opening their doors. But at the entrance to the Sabaya Cafe, they roll down the curtains to keep out men's prying eyes. Sabaya is the first women-only cafe in Jordan, just about the only place outside of her home where a woman can laugh, sing, be extroverted, and if she wears one, take off her veil. Darlene is a student and works as a waitress at the Sabaya.
It's not that they don't feel that comfortable around men, but our traditions, they don't let them do that. They feel like they're like, I don't know the word, ishmraqabin.
Censored.
Censored, yes. They feel censored.
Yeah.
All the time.
But what do you mean by censored?
Every time they want to do anything, they just feel like all eyes are on them.
Nada, an Iraqi Christian, also works at the cafe. For her, whether you're veiled or not, Muslim or Christian, the accepted role for women is generally out of public view. Okay, I'm Christian, she says, but I'm still an Arab. Wearing a veil poses a dilemma for a woman. It can be a shield as well as a shackle. A stranger in the marketplace will think twice before harassing her with his words or his hands. And busybodies won't accuse her of loose morals. But Hanin Majali, the Sabaya Cafe's owner, says her clients need to get away from the glare of the public eye, but also, sometimes, from their own families.
Everything around them tells them that don't do this. You know, her father, while she's young, you must not dress like this. While she's small, you know, if your friend say a joke and you just laugh loudly, you know, I'm sure that they won't like it, you know. She laughs. They just said like this. So you have to act formal. When men's there, they are shy, they have to act formally. They are not themselves, you know.
As evening approaches, the staff prepares for a full house, lining up the coffee cups and heating the coals for the hubbly bubbly water pipes that are a favorite in Arab coffee houses. A female singer from Tunisia will perform at the cafe tonight. As the women begin to arrive, a girl in a heavy jacket and white headscarf sees me recording and comes over. Amal is still a teenager and, it turns out, a bit of a hothead.
Okay, why are you here?
Because I don't like men too much. I hate them.
Why?
Because they confuse me, especially when I want to do something free here. So they will look at me and I will be ashamed. So I want to be alone without men here.
You're taking off your veil right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Because there's no men here.
And you're wearing a short sleeve shirt?
What?
Your shirt has short sleeves?
Yeah. Yeah.
But over it you have a jacket.
Yeah, because in our religion, it's in the veil, you should cover your hands and your legs. Without your face.
Here's some pictures for the... Some pictures from now.
The singer Munia moves to the stage. Her backup band is a karaoke machine. Emma comes over in between sets. She is transformed. Her hair is styled, and she's wearing lip gloss and dangly earrings. She's going to sing, and she wants me to record it.
You will be here, the last?
I will, I'm staying.
Yeah, because I will sing a song here.
Amal takes the mic and sings fearlessly in front of this group of maybe 30 women. Maybe it's my Western bias, but I can't help feeling a pang of sadness. Teenage dreams of stardom are always remote, but for Emel, they are absolutely, positively beyond reach. This room is as far as she will go. Meanwhile, this is still the place to have fun and, for a little while at least, block out the outside world.
That's the nice feeling here. You don't think. You sit in any way you want. You know, you laugh in any way you want. If you want to say a joke, even loud, you know? You will say it, and the next table will laugh with you.
We just saw the pictures.
And about our kids, about our life, everything.
And our adventure.
Yeah.
We still remember our days in biking, and how was it?
It was very nice, really.
Reporter Kristen Gillespie visited the Sabaya Cafe in Amman, Jordan. Tomorrow on Here and Now, who wants to be John Kerry's running mate? Raise your hand. We review the candidates. And actor Kevin Kline on Cole Porter. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In ports and on the high seas, new national and international maritime security regulations go into effect today. The new rules are intended to reduce the threat of seaborne terrorism. But as Here and Now's Alan Cockle reports, they have major implications for the U.S. Coast Guard and ships and ports around the world.
At the port of Boston, a four-story rolling crane transfers a shipping container to the back of a waiting truck. 9 million such containers enter this country each year on thousands of different ships. Under the new rules, every port in the vast international network must now have a security plan on file with its own government. As part of the Boston plan, 6 port police officers are standing by to search vehicles entering the container facility, and a construction team is attaching a row of sharp metal spikes to the top of the port security wall.
We're issuing badges to everyone who's going to come onto our facilities. We're controlling the cars and what can go onto the facility as well. We've increased our perimeter security.
Mike Leone is the director of the Boston Port and the chairman of the American Association of Port Authorities.
The other part I think that has been a significant improvement in overall security is the sharing of information. Post 9/11, the relationship that all of the terminals, all of the federal and local law enforcement agencies have, that we formed an area security committee where we meet regularly to pass information. We have a greater ability to understand what the threats are and to direct our resources so that we can respond to those. And those are the things I think that are important.
Leone says Boston is ready, and Homeland Defense Secretary Tom Ridge said last week that all U.S. ports will meet today's security deadline. A much bigger problem may be security in other countries where U.S.-bound cargo originates, particularly ports in the developing world. Kim Peterson is the president of SeaSecure, the nation's largest maritime security and risk management company.
Well, the implications are significant because any port that fails to be certified by their government as being compliant with these new international and U.S. regulations by the 1 July deadline face the prospect of being isolated commercially. That is, that other ports will not accept ships that have visited them because the port is considered potentially contaminated and could be the source for terrorists or a weapon of mass destruction, for example.
Last week, the International Maritime Organization, which oversees international shipping, reported that only 10% of the world's 6,000 ports had met the new security requirements. The major ports, where most U.S.-bound cargo originates, were expected to be in compliance by today. U.S. Customs and Border Patrol agents now screen containers in 19 of those busy ports. Additional security measures require cargo manifests to be sent to the Coast Guard at least 24 hours before cargo is loaded in a foreign port. And under the new rules, all ships must now give 72 hours advance notice before arriving and must carry security certificates issued by their flag state.
Group 41337, Roger, underway at this time. 20 POB en route, Boston Harbor.
337 to Boston.
Beginning today, the Coast Guard will intercept and inspect every foreign ship on its first visit to a U.S. port. Lieutenant Commander Joe Higgins says some of those interceptions will be carried out using a 41-foot boat like this Coast Guard vessel in Boston Harbor.
Sometimes we'll work with the agent and they'll know we're coming. Sometimes we'll do a boarding where we just show up alongside and then go aboard, and we'll check crew documentation, check the security certificates. Then what we'll do is when we're doing a walk through the vessel, we'll keep an eyeball out just, and if there's evidence, significant evidence, that the vessel is not operating in accordance with their security plan, then we, you know, there's the potential for further action. You know, you set as many barriers to people who are going to want to do terrorist activities or, you know, piracy. And hopefully you've set enough barriers that they're going to trip over them, and we're able to stop them from what their intended purpose is.
The Coast Guard says it has enough resources to carry out the increased inspections. But Cole Landers, a maritime security consultant with the Operations Security Group in Boston, isn't so sure.
The enforcement aspect, the side that says, okay, let's go out and check and see, is weak. There's few dollars put in place. There's no separate enforcement group per se. The Coast Guard is stretched as it is in terms of just the regular maritime duties. So there's a risk factor to that.
The Coast Guard has estimated the 10-year cost of implementing the maritime security rules at over $7 billion. To date, Congress has appropriated only $500 million. To put it another way, that's about one penny for every 30 cents allocated to the airline industry since September 11th. In addition to container traffic, ships carry over 300 billion gallons of petroleum and other bulk commodities and over 6 million passengers into U.S. ports every year. Security experts like Kim Peterson of SeaSecure say maritime security is much better than it was 2 years ago, but no system can hope to physically inspect every last ship or container.
The soft underbelly of the United States may well be viewed as the maritime industry. And we have already seen two attacks by al-Qaeda, one against a U.S. warship, the USS Cole, and the other against an oil tanker, the VLCC Lindbergh. These happened just in the last 3 years. So we know al-Qaeda has its sights on maritime targets. The ISPS code and these new international and U.S. regulations are a solid step forward in strengthening our nation against a potential terror attack. But it's just the first step. We now have to move forward and create a culture of security in an industry where security was typically a secondary or tertiary concern.
That report from Here Now's Alan Cockle. For maritime photos, visit our website, here-now.org. This note, in anticipation of this summer's Democratic and Republican national conventions in Boston and New York City, some property owners near the convention sites are adding terrorism coverage to their insurance policies. The Wall Street Journal reports that 9 owners of offices and hotels near Boston's Fleet Center have for the first time bought insurance that covers losses resulting from a terrorist attack. And a business owner in New Jersey who said he never felt vulnerable before now says New Jersey is just too close to Manhattan's Madison Square Garden for comfort. Meanwhile, MSNBC is reporting that in the first quarter of this year, more than 44% of U.S. businesses took out insurance to cover terrorism risk. That's the highest pickup rate for this kind of coverage since 2002, when the government passed the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. Still to come, the Polyphonic Spree. For a while, anyone could join this group. Now they number 27 members, singing about sunshine on the soundtrack for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and wowing audiences when they open for David Bowie. We'll meet the leader of the Spree. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Ellie Brenner of Concord, Massachusetts, wrote, concerning the piece we did about members of Congress participating in a coronation of the Reverend Sun Myung-moon in the Dirksen Senate office building. Ellie writes, my son was recruited into the Mooney organization when he was a college student. During his almost 5-year separation from our family, I was plunged into a world of secrecy and deception. He was told that I was Satan. Finally, my son came home and was able to examine for himself the deception and lies that he was exposed to. For many, the mention of Moon may bring a smile, even laughter, but I almost lost my only child. That any elected official should align themselves with the Unification Church is deeply unsettling. Thanks for shedding some light on this topic. Well, we received a lot of feedback after my commentary on beheadings. In part, I asked, if we get used to beheadings, do the terrorists win? Stephen DiCarlo of Sewell, New Jersey, responded, sadly, I believe you're correct. My question is, if they're so proud of their actions that they publish them on the Internet, why do they hide their faces? And we received this criticism from S. Rubatsky. I had successfully avoided the recent beheadings in Iraq. How dare you describe the horror without warning? Well, we do want to apologize. We should have included a warning before describing the beheadings. Richard Simone had this criticism after our piece about Boston Transit Police conducting random searches of commuters on the trains. He writes, instead of buying into the line that the searches will be random, why not ask the people sponsoring the searches about the extent to which they will use racial and/or gender profiling to pre-select those who will be searched randomly? And finally, in our segment on the new film, The Corporation, we posed the question, if a corporation was a person, what kind of person would it be? Well, this prompted K.G. Hines of Jenkintown, Pennsylvania, to write, while indeed legally a corporation is considered a person, in point of fact, it is a company. For instance, a corporation can be sued, but it can't literally be sent to jail. Only people can. Ergo, your introductory sentence should have been put in the subjunctive case. What if the corporation were a person? The subjunctive case is used when the statement is contrary to actual fact, as in, I wish I were on vacation. Oh, don't we all? As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Oh, and that reminds us, we received these messages on our listener line following a story on the tennis tournament I called Wimbledon.
Hello, I love the show, I love NPR, but as an English citizen, I've been living in the United States since 1986, there is no T in Wimbledon. It is a suburb of London, and it is spelt W-I-M-B-L-E-D-O-N. There is no T. Thank you very much.
Third. Saved message.
And I just ranted on Wimbledon, and I forgot to leave my name and contact information. My name is Stanford, S-T-A-N-F-O-R-D, Thompson with a P, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N. I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I listen to you guys on W-H-Y-Y, and you have a tremendous organization. Thank you very much. Bye. Oh,
stay with us. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fans of the feel-good supergroup The Polyphonic Spree are eagerly awaiting this month's release of their new CD, Together We're Heavy. But on paper, the ensemble looks like a rock fan's worst nightmare. A 27-voice choir dressed in flowing white robes, singing about love and sunshine, sort of like the musical Hair with clothing. But somehow, The Polyphonic Spree makes it work. The The Polyphonics, as they're known in Britain, came together pretty much by accident and have been compared to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the P-Funk All-Stars, Jesus Christ Superstar, and The Cult. When they opened for David Bowie this spring, they wowed his hardcore crowd. The Spree's music laces the soundtrack for the hit film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And just like the Coke ad, they'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. Tim DeLauder is the force behind the Polyphonic Spree. He joins us in the studio. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, I don't want that responsibility to teach perfect harmony.
What do you want to do? What is this all about?
You know, I'm just having a good time, and that's basically all it was about. I was just trying to create some music that was going on in my head for some time, and that really turned me on and inspired me, and just so happens it kind of started taking off and inspiring other people.
Some people might remember that this year your music was used on the soundtrack to the film The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which felt perfect, by the way. Let's remind listeners.
Light and day is more than you'll say, 'cause all my feelings are more than I can let by or not. It's more than you've got, just follow the day. Follow the day and reach for the sun.
The music of Polyphonic Spree. Tim, your music has also been used in a Volkswagen commercial.
That's right.
And now you've got your first real album. By that I mean it's the first CD that you actually sat down and wrote, as opposed to your very first CD, which kind of just happened. How does a CD kind of just happen?
Well, it was we needed some music to be able to showcase for different promoters to let them know what we were about, because I wasn't getting anywhere. I was having a really difficult time getting shows because they thought logistically it was a nightmare.
Plus, how did you explain sort of the nature of it? There's a, you know, it's a celebration of positivity. So do people automatically picture Up With People?
I guess, you know, I don't ever really like to, to this day, I still don't quite know what the Polyphonic Spree is yet to me. it's a blast to be a part of, and it's, you know, I've got 20, 30 people around me all the time with this band, including my kids, and it's an amazing event that socially. I'm interacting with these people for the last 4 years.
Oh, are you kidding? I can just hear people saying, "Why didn't I think of that? How did you think of that? Were you in a choir growing up? Was there?"
You know, no, I wasn't in a choir. You know, I was raised in early 70s. Orchestral pop music was happening at the time, and as a kid, it was really. I really appreciated it. It was kind of along the same lines as the Walt Disney storybook records. And as a kid, it's really friendly, and I wouldn't say it's kind of religious, but it does have this kind of a, I don't know, spirited overtone to it, which was really infectious for me, and I think set the foundation for me to appreciate melody and become a songwriter.
Does it have a religious backing? I mean, are you a Christian musician? Or are you a born again? Or
I don't really know what I am at this point. I'm still on a journey right now. I think I'll figure it out later on.
Right. You mentioned all the positivity that was an influence, but we also understand there's very, you know, tragic occurrence as well. Your bandmate from Tripping Daisy, who died of a drug overdose.
Wes Berggren, who was one of the most sunniest human beings I've ever encountered, and I think I will ever encounter. He was an amazing individual, and that kind of took the wind out of everyone's sails that were around him at the time. And there had been almost a year gap in there before I even picked up a guitar. I really was kind of disenchanted with music overall when that happened. But I picked up the guitar. The first song I wrote was Sun. I was so engrossed in the idea of putting Polyphonic Spree together and writing more songs that I didn't really think about what was turning out.
back to some of the other musical influences. You were mentioning the Disney storybook CDs. And we're also reminded of the Purple Puzzle Tree albums, the Bible stories. They were popular also in the 70s.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with those, but I was, you know, going through my... It was just my mother and I growing up, and she was searching religiously, trying to find what her path was. And so I did go to some various revivals that I think were somewhat inspiring to me that were all based around music. Yeah. Big choir, music was amazing, yeah. And come on down and get saved. And so it was an interesting time. I think maybe the robes may have something to do with that.
Well, but speaking of the robes that you wear, these big flowing white robes, all 27, 30, however there are of you on the stage, why do you use them? Because I've read that some people think because you wear them, they think you're a cult.
Right.
Are you a cult?
No, not to my knowledge.
Okay. So why do you wear them?
I wear them because... I was thinking at the beginning when I'm, like, picturing all this in my head, I thought, you know, being in a rock world that I was for, like, 10 years, it's like fashion is just as important to the audience as what's going on the amplifiers. They seem to be able to think they can sum people up in general by what they're wearing, and that always kind of annoyed me. So I thought, you know, one way we could dissolve that is by having a unified cloth. And so first thing that came into mind was robes.
Well, when the choruses come into these songs, it is such a rush. I'm thinking of the song Diamonds, Devotion to Majesty. You know, you start off singing solo, then these voices come in. Now, you've said you wanted that sound without doing tons of tracking.
Yeah. Instead of just me singing by myself, I always thought it'd be nice to have 10 people singing as one to get the natural different voices happening and natural harmonies that kind of just go along with it. I just thought it sounds so much more interesting.
Holding on, sunshine.
Do I understand that you don't turn anyone down? That if someone wants to join the... This is dangerous, by the way, to say this on radio. But.
Yeah, it is, and it's gotten me in a lot of trouble. I think my band would strangle me if I were to bring any more people in. I know my wife would, who pretty much, you know, manages this whole orchestration.
Well, Tyndall Lauder, thank you so much, and thank you for not bringing the whole band in today.
I don't know if we could have fit in here, so no. That kind of worked out for both of us.
Tyndall Lauder, the heart behind the Polyphonic Spree. The group's new album is called Together We're Heavy.
Take the time to find the world another way. I want to be more than yesterday, and somehow find a way to this new.
I feel so much better. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Somehow find a way to your new religion. If the world collapses, I know I want to be yours in time. And somehow find a way to your new religion. If the world collapses,
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.